Welcome to Money Talks, and as I say every week, I sincerely appreciate you coming. Got several notes this week, by the way, of people who say they recommend Money Talks to other people, and I think I really appreciate that, but I think this is such an incredible time in our country's history. There's so much going on. Today, we're going to talk with Terry Glavin. He's been on the Chinese interference file for, what, 15 years plus? Well, he's going to give us his summation of what we learned in the public inquiry. Maybe not so much what we learned, because a lot of this news had sort of been pieced out, but to see it all together, at least I personally found it absolutely astounding. Plus, you know, federal budget this week, the big piece of news seems to be that they increased the capital gains tax. The exemption has been raised or lowered. The exemption's lowered and you pay more on your capital gains. But we're going to talk with Tim Cesnak about that. He says the government is not really being accurate when they suggest it only impacts a small number of people. There's many ways it does. Plus, I'm going to get him to give us some last-minute tax tips. If you miss something, you can always go back. But I wanted you to be aware of that, given that taxes are the biggest cost of living for most Canadians. And saying that, yeah, we got a federal budget this week. My first observation, by the way, is how fast it disappeared from sort of the news headlines and the talk shows. Seems like a shelf life of something like 2 days, which is very short, I think, for a document that details how, for most of us, our biggest cost of living, our personal expense, our taxes, and the details how that's spent. I mean, the budget had a lot of focus on housing, with a big promise to build 3.87 million homes in the next 7 years. What is that, 553,000 homes per year? In a country that's lucky to get even close to half of that? I think there's no chance, which is a reminder that we should take everything in the budget with a big grain of salt and a critical eye. You know, my favorite say what moment, say what line in the budget was Finance Minister Freeland stating in quotes, "It would be irresponsible and unfair to pass more debt to the next generation." And then she proceeded to project a deficit every year. I mean, what are we supposed to do with that? The numbers are black and white. Under the Liberals, the federal debt has more than doubled. They've run a deficit every year and are going to continue according to their own forecasts. And yet they're saying it would be irresponsible and unfair to pass more debt to the next generation. You know what? That's one of the examples of why I keep coming back to, you just can't make this stuff up. But I do agree with the finance minister. It's unfair, irresponsible to continue to pass on record debt to our children and their children. But it obviously bothers me a lot more than it does her. I think it's fair to say, though, with this year's budget deficit forecast of $39.9 billion, I think that exposes that despite what the government said in the past, debt and deficits are way down their list of priorities. But that's not all. A more immediate problem than the debt buildup for young people, yeah, is housing. Both the lack of affordable rents, overall affordable housing, but also the overall cost of living. So I don't think deficits rank that high in at least a lot of people's list of concerns. They may know it's important, but not that high because they've got more immediate pressing problems. And as for the familiar cry to raise business taxes, well, Scotiabank economist Rebecca Young did a report just released a week or so ago that even when you adjust for inflation, corporate taxes have doubled in the past decade. But this is important to note. At that same time, over that same period, our real GDP has grown by just 17%. And most of that's because of the huge influx and the huge growth in our population. And again, at the same period of time, though, spending and the public sector have increased by 40%. An increase in the size of government, though, ever more areas of intervention, along with a massive increase in the cost of government, taxation, public debt, well, I think we should be aware that's at the heart of the NDP Liberal agenda. Some people support it, some don't. You know, their priorities are climate change, LGBTQ policy, and more government. We should note, though, that even after the Bank of Canada had that unprecedented warning a week or two ago about declining productivity, it said it had reached an emergency status, there was actually no mention of productivity in the budget, let alone policies to encourage growth or encourage capital coming into this country. I think that's what got most economists talking. And what was the government's response, by the way, to that Bank of Canada warning, echoed by so many economists? It was to raise capital gains taxes. And that comes on top. It's not just that in isolation. You've got to see that in the broader context of more costly regulation, increased payroll taxes, you know, and the regular anti-business rhetoric. No, Canada, they did nothing to improve our reputation as a place to invest. That should worry us. But I'm going to leave the final word to Chrystia Freeland's immediate predecessor. Final word about the budget. Bill Morneau stated in response to the increase in capital gains, in quotes, "This was very clearly something that, while I was there, we resisted. We resisted it for a very specific reason. We were concerned about the growth of the country," he went on to say, in quotes, "clearly a negative to our long-term goal, which is growth in the economy, productive growth, and investments." Well, you can't dismiss that easily because it's certainly not a partisan comment. No, that's what was reflected in so many economists' take on this. But what the budget confirms is over the last 8 years has shown us economic growth is not a priority for the Liberal government, reflected in our GDP per capita, investment per capita, stagnating incomes, and now the federal budget. As I say, we've got a great show planned for you. Lots coming with Ozzie Jurek on the housing file, Rob Levy more on the budget coming up, and Victor Adair on another incredibly volatile week in the market. So stay with us. Glad you're here on Money Talks. Well, we just got a budget. That changed some tax-related things. But also, of course, for individuals filing, we're coming up to the end of the month. Also, if you're self-employed or in business, you've got June 15th. All of it's coming to roost. That's what I'm so pleased to welcome back to our show, Tim Cesnik. Tim is CEO of Our Family Office. But you see him writing in the Globe and Mail, so many other places. He's written, you know, some of the best books I've seen on tax, period, you know, Tim. So very pleased to have you back on the show. Appreciate it. It's a very busy time of year for you.
Oh, it's always great to join you, Mike. I'm glad to do this anytime.
Well, and I'm sort of thinking, and this is a little busier this week, given the timing of the budget. All right. Just a little anecdote. You must have been flooded with emails, et cetera, when you saw the change to the capital gains, for example. I mean, people are running around on that one.
Yeah, I was actually in the budget lockup, and at 4 o'clock when the embargo lifted and we were all free to go, my phone was immediately ringing off the hook, and I had 15 emails in the next hour just talking about the changes and the impact. And, you know, it's kind of a joke that the government thinks that the capital gains tax changes will affect 37,000 people or something crazy. Yeah. It's going to affect millions of people. So that's really disingenuous. But anyway, we're going to spend a lot of time planning for that in the next few weeks.
And just a quick, as you say, there's lots of talk to come on that. But I mean, I've got a friend who has a family cabin and up in a lovely part of British Columbia, waterfront. We call it the Sunshine Coast, Gibson's. You know, people have heard of that no matter where they are, you know, Seashelt. I'm trying to think of that. The Beachcombers was filmed in Gibson's. But so it's been in the family 50 years. And you can imagine the change in real estate prices there. So, I mean, it's affecting someone like him. You know,
absolutely.
And there's just so many more examples. And the assumption that that's not out there, you know, it just is mind-blowing. As you said, it was an absurdity. There's a few absurdities. I won't put you on the spot with it. But guess what, Tim? I'm not betting we're building 3.87 million houses. I'll be dealing with that later in the show. But come on, I don't think I'm putting my money down on that bet. There's a few absurdities in that budget, as I talked about at the top of the show. But yeah, that's another one. It's going to affect a lot of people.
Absolutely. And, you know, the good news is there's an election and coming up in another year or so. So maybe we'll have a chance to, if we're not happy with how things are going, maybe make some changes. Yep. But, you know, things have to change. The tax law is becoming unbearably more complex every year. And I mean, we could go down, talk for that, but with that for hours, but, you know, we won't.
but you're true. I mean, I've said, and I'm not trying to convince anybody of anything. You have to see what's going on and make a choice. And, you know, this is a government that's chosen to be much more intrusive, much bigger, whether we're measuring in terms of the cost of government, whether we're measuring the record debt to pay for a lot of that expansion into other areas. You know, so there's a very clear choice. And this is just another aspect of it. But it'll be, I haven't really seen, and it may have come out, and I haven't just, there's been a lot on our plates, you know, analyzing this and talking about it. So I don't know what the conservative position is, but right now I think business people in general are seeing this as one of many, many regulatory approaches or tax approaches that discourage capital investment. Simple as that. And we had the Ontario Medical Association came out and said it's going to make it tougher to attract individual doctors.
Absolutely. And that's because they brought in some expanded the exemption for small business corporations, the capital gains, but they didn't allow it to apply to doctors or professional corporations. They can't take advantage of it. So the laws become a lot more complex when you start trying to sift certain people out of certain rules or include certain people in the rules and not others in the rules. It gets to be unbearably complicated.
Yeah, and it's puzzling why. I mean, think about that. We have a housing shortage, for example. I mean, I don't think there's any debate on that. The government's acknowledged it themselves. You know, we need 3.87 million more houses. Why do you put anything in that could dissuade someone from investing in the housing market to increase supply? Or in the case that you've just alluded to, we know there's a family doctor shortage. You know, I mean, yes. No one's debating that one. Well, why would you do anything that could be interpreted as negative in attracting medical professionals?
I know I don't want to take all our time talking about this, but it's interesting. My family owns a piece of property in Ontario that we've had rezoned because it can hold more homes on it than it does. 12 stacked townhouses, not a big property. And we were ready to go ahead and build this. The problem is now it's more cost effective for me from a tax point of view to just sell that piece of property right now than to build it out and sell units later and pay more capital gains tax after June 25th. So I'm not as motivated to actually go ahead and actually construct this now.
I can't tell you how often I've heard that already in just a few days, you know, that the budget's been out. Immediately I did, and I did put this on social media because it was 10 minutes later, I got two separate people emailing me saying, you know, I'm out of here. I mean, out of here in terms of the real estate. I already feel that way myself because it's too onerous when you do a municipal, provincial. This is federal, of course. That's really worrisome. That should be really sort of a flashing red warning light that that's been the response. Because again, I'll come back to the government, or I've seen some analysis by some economists who look at this as a one, like when I say one off, that's all they're examining. They don't know the huge regulatory landscape we're dealing with, the huge taxation landscape we're dealing with, and an attitude that says it's not worth it. The hassle is not worth it. Now I can get 5% in a government bond, so I'm home free. You know what I mean? That's what I'm taking, you know, hassle free. I'll just take that. Boy, that is not the reaction we need in housing and not the reaction we need in health, you know. So let me come to this year's taxes, and I'll come back to the budget in a second, but I want to come to this year's taxes. So we've got our deadline, as I said at the outset here. If you probably hate to think of how many people you've advised or how many tax forms you've looked at, you know, in a long career, but just give us a quick list of the warning from Tim Cesnick, who says, you know what, just double check you got this, or just make sure you got this.
Yeah, I think first of all, when it comes to filing your tax return, number one, make sure you do file it on time, because if you don't file your return on time, especially if you owe money, okay, if you owe money and you don't file on time, you're going to pay a penalty. Even if you can't pay the taxes up today, file your return on time, because the penalty is going to be 5% automatically the next day after you filed your return late. And then there is an ongoing penalty for every month you're late filing that return of another 1% per month. So you don't want to file the return late. Now, as far as paying the taxes you might owe, the interest rate on overdue taxes now is now double digits. It's now 10%. So that's very, very high. It's the highest it's been in many years. So if you can't pay your taxes, you might actually consider borrowing money to pay your tax bill if you have to, because the interest rate might be lower than what the government's going to charge you.
I just want to revisit those numbers, because that is a change. As you said, so I did file, so I avoided that 5% automatic penalty, but now I don't have the money, and I'm not sending it in or whatever. Holy smokes. Over 10%, you know, what are they, the mafia? I mean, seriously, isn't that, when do usury rates sort of kick in on this stuff?
Slightly under credit card rates. It's crazy, yeah.
But your point's well taken. Maybe you have another way of borrowing that. So, I mean, 10%, if you're starting and looking at 10%, or a percent a month, for goodness sakes. See if you can't get a rate that's better than that and pay it off. I mean, but as I say, that's mind-blowing. You know, that should have been my shocking stat, Tim.
We never used to, you know, for the last number of years, we've never talked about the interest rate and overdue taxes because it hasn't been meaningful. Yeah. But today it is very meaningful. The other thing you want to do is, because interest rates have gone up so much and people who are incurring interest, you want to make sure, first of all, if you can, to deduct the cost of your interest, because that will reduce the overall cost. Now, not everyone can deduct their interest because maybe they didn't use the board money for business or just income-producing purposes. There's a way to fix that in some cases. You could, for example, if you had access to some cash or some investments, you could take those investments or that cash, you could pay down your debt that's not deductible,
right?
And then re-borrow to replace your investments or your cash in your bank, and all of a sudden, you can now deduct the interest cost because you're borrowing for the purpose of earning income. And so I would encourage people to think about restructuring their debt a little bit. If they, we call it a debt swap, to make your interest deductible. So make sure you're looking at all the interest you've paid and to ask the question, can I deduct my interest now? Very, very important. Higher income earners have to be concerned about something called the alternative minimum tax, which is they've changed the rules around that. We'll get into the details of it, but if you're making over $173,000 a year, which puts you into the high income bracket, you have to be concerned about this new second tax that you might have to pay instead, which might be more than your regular tax, and just talk to a tax professional about planning for that if that's the case. I think also just you want to make sure more than ever you're not missing any deductions and credits that you are entitled to. So things like, obviously, medical expenses, there's always an expanding list of what will qualify for medical expenses. So make sure you've checked that out. Obviously, childcare expenses, self-employment losses are still very helpful. So if you've started a business last year, or even if you didn't make any money in that business yet, you can still report the expenses. You can still, you know, claim your losses, and those losses can often be applied against other kinds of income you're earning, and that'll save you tax. So self-employment is still one of the greatest tax shelters available because you can deduct the cost of anything that was incurred, any cost incurred for the purpose of earning income from the business.
Can we, and on that, let's say I've got a, just remind us about the home office kind of rules, because of course that became even more prominent during COVID and, you know, whatever you were considering. So now, so how do I handle that? Like, let's say I use a room and it's got to be dedicated. It's dedicated for you know, my business. Do I just simply take the kind of estimate the percentage of square footage that is? Like, if I've got a 1,500 square foot home, I'm making it, you can tell my math because I'm making it very
easy. Sure, sure.
150 square foot office space in a separate part of the house. It might have, could have been a bedroom, but instead I'm using an office. So now that's 10%. Do I now take 10% of my mortgage payments, utilities, any other costs associated with home? But that's how I determine how much to apportion to my home business.
Yes, that's right. Now, it depends on whether you're an employee or you're self-employed. Mm. So employees can claim a deduction for home office expenses if the employer requires you to work from home. If you're just voluntarily, if you're just saying, no, I just prefer to work from home, I'm just choosing to, then you can't actually claim any home office expenses. But if you're required to, and that requirement has to be for half the time or more. So if you, but if that, that's the category you fall into, then you can claim expenses. Self-employed people, it's a bit different because you're self-employed. If you need part of your home as a home office, you can claim home office expenses. And the list of things you can claim as a self-employed person is a little bit broader. You can claim mortgage interest and property taxes, whereas employees can claim everything else, not mortgage interest, not property taxes.
So big distinction. Are you self-employed and your employer has to requested you say you can, I guess during COVID, everyone could claim that because you were supposed to stay home, but we're post COVID right now. So the employer has to say work from home. That's
and it doesn't have to be in writing. As long as your employer requires you, just says, hey, verbally, yeah, you've got to be at home. Then you can claim an deduction, but your employer does have to sign a form in case CRA comes asking for it. It's called T2200. So make sure you get that if you're an employee.
When you talk about expenses, is there something that you find people miss? You know, one of the things that I know that people maybe don't appreciate, you can pool your charitable expenses or pool your medical expenses. Yeah. You know,
and you'll save a little bit more tax by doing that. You know, not going to make you rich, but if you claim all your donations on one spouse's return, if there are two of you, You'll save more tax, probably $50 more in tax than if you separate the expenses and claim them on two returns. So that's a mistake people make. People also make a mistake by claiming deductions in the wrong year. So for example, if you make an RSP contribution, or even now a contribution to the new first-time home buyer's savings account, you're entitled to a tax deduction for the money you put into those plans. But the question is, are you going to be making more money next year, like, or maybe 2024 or 2025 than you're making this year? Will you be in a higher tax bracket in this year or next year? If the answer is yes, then you should probably be saving that tax deduction for next year. Yeah. It'll save you more tax next year. So you can claim it this year, but it may say you save you less tax if in 2023 your income wasn't as high. So we see that often as a problem. And another problem, some people who are lower income might claim enough of a tax credit or deduction, whether it's tuition or whether it's RSP contributions, to bring their income below the point where they're paying any tax. Mm-hmm. Well, don't claim so much that you're not going to pay any tax on less than $15,000 of income anyway. So don't bring your income below that level by claiming a deduction. So if the deduction can be saved for next year.
And that just brings to me, let's say I don't think I owe any tax. You know, I am low. I made $14,000 or something. And I'm talking students are part of this, you know, summer students, et cetera. Do you still file, I guess, is the bottom line. Do you still file and say, well, I don't owe anything, so I'm not filing? What's the advantage of actually filing?
Yeah, there's a big advantage to filing if you are 19 years of age or older, and if you had any earned income at all. So you earned any income doing anything. The reason you want to file is, number one, you may not pay any tax if your income's under $15,000 or so, but you'll accumulate RSP contribution room, mm-hmm. so that later you'll be able to put money into your RSP. That's good. And on top of that, if you are a low-income earner, but you file a return and you're 19 or older, you can collect a GST credit, which is cash in your hands. They'll pay you send you money every quarter. It's about $400 a year, but it's free and you might as well collect it. So yeah. File a return.
You know, just listening, and obviously you're encyclopedic on this, but it just tells me the degree to which the tax rules have become so much more complicated, you know, and it makes sense as the government is an interventionist government. They're into more areas and it's expanding still. I mean, that's what we've heard in the budget. It just has become so complicated for individuals. You know, I mean, yes. I feel like we don't have a chance.
I mean, let me give you an example, really simple, of that. After the budget this week, there are now three capital gains inclusion rates that could apply to you. Mm. There's a 50% rate we've seen for the last 20 years. There is the new two-thirds rate, which they introduced in the budget. Or if you're subject to alternative minimum tax, which under the new rules, it could be 100% capital gains inclusion rate.
Yeah.
So, and it could be, you could pay more tax at more than one of those rates. So, I mean, it is unbearably complicated, and the average person has really no chance to properly plan for or do their taxes properly anymore. It's if you have any kind of complexity at all, you're going to need a tax specialist. And the administrative cost of filing taxes has gone up exponentially because of all of this.
And another great point, because that won't be reflected in StatsCan cost of living stuff, you know, in their inflationary numbers, you know, right. Another a major part. And it is, I think the fact that it's so confusing, it's the depth you need, it really discourages people. And I think it turns people off too, but I think it discourages people. And sign that anyone wants to simplify that, because you know, you always think of what would get my vote, if you know what I mean. And people have a wide range of values or priorities, you know. And I've described this current situation as pretty broad. I think it's clear that the number one priority for the federal Liberal government is climate change, and I can give you 58 reasons why I think that, you know. And obviously they pay a lot of attention to LGBTQ issues. On the other side, and now they're just jumping into housing. People forget that it was as late as August of this year, the prime minister said it wasn't a federal responsibility. Then then they saw the polls. All of a sudden it's, you know, an announcement, you know, every week. But, you know, so it's, but anyways, they have other priorities, and it's not economic growth. It's not GDP per capita. It's not investment per capita. It's not actual cost of living, because they've contributed so much to that increase. So, you know, people have to make a choice on this. But as I say, I just sort of shake my head at how discouraging it is for people, how overwhelming it is. And right back to what we said at the outset, I know so many people, I'm in a unique position. I get a lot of communications thrown at me. The give up is maybe the most common thing. Well, I'm just not going to do any investing anymore. I'm not, you know, I'm pulling in my horns, you know, kind of thing.
Well, the other thing too, I'd mention, if you do file your return and CRA comes back and asks for more information, which they might do, they've made it very difficult to actually comply with in a reasonable manner with the tax. I'll give you an example. I recently got audited for my home office expenses, as many Canadians did. And so they sent me a long letter asking me for information about my home office expenses, and literally the number of receipts and statements that I had to send to CRA was about 1,000.
Oh my God.
About 1,000. When I added it all up, the pages were about 1,000. Now, I didn't send everything to them because I wasn't going to accumulate 1,000 pages of documentation, because it would have saved me about $300 in tax.
Yeah. I had a similar with our – sorry, I interrupted, but it just reminds me, somebody who works with us on Money Talks got audited for their travel, you know, mainly car travel, you know, they're self-employed. And the hassle, they wanted exactly the same. Well, I want – where did you pay? You know, I want the receipt for the gas, exactly what you were doing, you know, why it was an office expense. And I said the same thing. I said, you better make a quick guess at how much, you know, you didn't claim that much. It was like $2,000 at your rate. Right. It's not, you know, $500. Well, no.
For me, you know, here's the problem. People are just going to say, I'm just not going to claim the expense then. I'm not going to claim it because I can't comply with the administrative burden to provide you with information. There's a problem with our tax law when you're entitled to a deduction, but you just can't claim it because you can't comply administratively.
Yeah.
There's a real problem.
Huge. And look, it's obvious it's getting worse. That's the other thing. I mean, on the broad scale, it's just getting worse. And I just wonder.
An example of that is the underused housing tax return, which many people now have to file. And 99% of those returns result in no taxes owing at all.
Yeah.
But people have to file them by April 30th if they have a company that owns a piece of real estate or trust that owns a piece of real estate. It's just an information gathering process for the government, and it's overreaching, and it really is not providing any value to anybody.
Let me finish with one quick question. Is that okay? So let's, you know, I'll make it an easy one for me. You know, you say, oh, I didn't include that charitable receipt. Or maybe I didn't cruise any, you know, and I'm always pushing for Special Olympics. So, you know, I maybe have 10 of those, you know, what do I do now?
If you've forgotten, first of all, if you've either forgotten a deduction or a credit that you should have claimed and you realize after the fact you forgot, you can actually file an adjustment to your return. You don't have to file an amended tax return. It's not that complicated. You get a form called T1ADJ, which stands for adjustment. And it's a one-page form. You fill it out. You say, here's what I originally put on my return. Here's the right number. They may ask you for evidence of, you know, a receipt or something to prove you had the expense. But as long as you provide that, you should probably just send it to them along with your form. Then they'll make an adjustment to your return. And also realize, too, if they do come back and ask you for something as simple as a donation receipt because you claimed something on your return, count yourself fortunate, because that's not that complicated to provide that. It becomes a lot more challenging when you've claimed home office expenses and you've prorated it, and they want you to send a diagram of your home with your, you know, all of that stuff gets very, very time consuming. But make sure you do keep your receipts, because they may actually reach out to you and say, can you send us that donation receipt? Send us that medical expense. Yeah. And then you can upload that to what's called My Account online, which you should, everyone should be subscribing to.
Yeah. Well, as I say, I know this is an incredibly busy time, and I appreciate you taking your time, and always, as you do, helping out the Money Talks audience here. Tim Cesnik is CEO of Our Family Office. Tim, wonderful as usual. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
Time now for the shocking stat of the week. And for it, I'm going to ask you a question. Now, if you bought a house in 1990 for $400,000, and then you sold it this year for $825,000, how much do you think you gained? I'm going to repeat that. You bought a house in 1990 for $400,000, and it sold this year for $825,000. How much did you gain? Well, the answer is zero in terms of things you could buy with the proceeds. Zero in terms of what your money can buy. In other words, the dollar's purchasing power. Why? Because of inflation. You need $825,000 today to purchase what $400,000 could buy in 1990. Now think about that in the context of the capital gains, because the federal government thinks it's fair to raise taxes on capital gains, but without adjusting for inflation. So in the case I just gave, you didn't make anything, but you're still going to pay tax, makes it a losing proposition. It's just another example when politicians use the word fair, well, the BS follows close behind. And by the way, the word fair appeared 50 times in the budget. And it's also a reminder that, as famed economist Milton Friedman said, inflation is taxation without legislation. Now, as regular listeners and attendees to the World Outlook Conference know, I think that's the biggest challenge for all of us, protecting ourselves from the declining purchasing power of the dollar. Big time deal. Made more difficult, though, by increased taxation, as the federal budget illustrates. You know, I mentioned at the top of the show, it's kind of interesting, that the budget was sort of like a day and a half story. It's the biggest document coming out of government. You know, it's the biggest expense for most Canadians, even over, you know, their food budget, over their shelter budget, is, of course, taxation and what the government's doing, impact in so many areas. The government is committed to more intervention, you know, a bigger footprint in Canadian society. And yet, my impression was it rated about a day and a half, you know, of coverage. I'm going to bring Rob Levy in that. I don't know about you, Rob, but did you happen to notice the same thing? Like talk shows? Well, that was it. We did 15 minutes on it, so we're not doing that anymore. You know, it wasn't really in the newscast as prominently. Almost immediately, though, and I thought that was very telling.
It is, Mike, and you know, part of it, perhaps the Canadians have just fallen numb to the notion of deficit spending and a government that goes further into debt, because, you know, these budgets have almost, in a sense of them, become a bit of a farce. They're meaningless because all they're doing is just adding on program spending year after year.
And good word there, because I mentioned in opening comment, of course, that, you know, they promise, 3.87 million homes, but we know they don't have a plan for that. They say they don't have a plan. When they were pressed for details, we don't have details. You know, and I just think, did you laugh harder at that? Or as I said at the opening, or when Chrystia Freeland said, you know, it's unfair to pass along deficits to our children, and then proceeds to pass another one on. You know, I mean, I think you're right. There's certainly proving they have a good sense of humor.
Fair enough. But, you know, the numbers that just stand out to me, and this is past pandemic, and it was a time when the government stepped up because everyone was wondering what was going on in the economy, and they figured they needed to have spend and inject dollars into the Canadian economy. We saw it all over the Western world. But back to 2021 and predicted to where we would be today, we're $55 billion further in debt, more program spending that the government's take us on. And it was always the notion that we were going to start to rein that back in when we were spending over that COVID time period. So it's just the fact that we have these budgets now year in, year out, and it's the growth in spending. Now program spending, you know, on average, when it runs at about low 14% of GDP, it's up around 16% of GDP. It's the additional dollars that are being spent year in, year out. And there's no notion, thought process, how are we going to rein this in? How are we going to cut?
Yeah, I think that reflects. I mean, we have choices politically in the country, and some people want ever bigger government, you know, and they've certainly produced that. It's most expensive in history, the most employees in history, you know, into more areas. I mean, we've added pharmacare, daycare, dental care, you know, that list goes on and on. Well, I want to acknowledge there's a chunk of the Canadian public who loves that. You know, they want bring it on. And then there's another side to the Canadian public that worries about the finances, the implications, the size of the tax bill. That to me is this the divide that people are going to have to choose which future they want. But the one thing is very clear. I mean, the only thing I'd be critical of is, come on, it's pretty clear that their concern over feigned concern over deficits, you know, over the last 8 years has been baloney. I mean, they're not concerned about the deficit whatsoever, and they're not concerned about the debt. I mean, there's no sign that they are.
No. And even too, as you talk about how they're going to finance it, it's just their forecasts are so rosy for a Canadian government that says an economy that's performing a little better than they figured it would. And, you know, this is an economy that, you know, grew at 1% last year when you had record immigration inflow, the most since Newfoundland joined Confederation all the way back to 1948. So it's just, you know, it's an economy that's not performing well. Inflation forecasts that are probably too high, meaning nominal GDP is going to disappoint. So, you know, even what they're projecting as a deficit is probably going to end up being better than expected because they're spending more and there's going to be revenue shortfalls. So I think from that perspective as well, it just spells a little bit of trouble ahead.
And it doesn't matter where you are in the political spectrum. I mean, when you spend $54 billion, more than a billion a week on interest payments, you're more vulnerable. You know, it limits the choices you have. And I think people have to appreciate that it doesn't matter what policies in place, there are consequences, there are repercussions, you know, there are trade-offs. So, yeah, I think for some, again, people who are worried about stability in a world that is awash with sovereign debt problems, you know, we're not positioning ourselves as a stable, you know, as a more safe and stable. And that brings me to the other thing is that, you know, we had two credit downgrades in British Columbia. You know, we had Bloomberg saying Canada is the most likely developed nation to get a credit downgrade. That's hardly good news. And there's nothing in the budget that would suggest they're worried about it.
No, because you look how they're running the nation's finances, and it's only going to be further pressure, especially with a budget like we received this week. The fact that it puts further pressure on interest rates staying at more elevated levels, meaning we're going to be continuing to serve more of our budget with interest costs because there's pressure on those to the upside. And, you know, it relates to what you said about a credit rating warning that's potentially to come from a budget like this. But it was even a warning from the IMF out of Washington this week towards the United States, but particularly I think we should listen to it in Canada, and it's the fact that this continued fiscal spending, the question of whether or not it's sustainable and how it then aligns with your fiscal and monetary goals, it only puts pressure on interest rate policy, and it makes it that much more of a challenge to lower interest rates when you have a budget like this.
Yeah, they have to appreciate two things come out of it: upward pressure on inflation, you know, the government spending at that level, and as they say, the debt servicing costs get higher. And that's why, Rob, my big thing is, I think it's not the right question to be asking, is the debt sustainable? Not for individuals. Individuals should ask, what are the repercussions of them building up this debt? You know, how do I handle it on a personal financial level? And of course, that gives us tons of stuff to talk about. And I appreciate you taking time and talking with us, Rob. And I want to just remind people, you can go find Rob at bordergold.com, right?
Bordergold.com.
There you go. I always hesitate, .ca.com. Bordergold.com, though. And Rob writes a weekly column there on the gold market, what's happening, all sorts of things there, bordergold.com. Rob Levy, thanks for finding time.
Always nice to be with you. Thank you, Mike.
We're very fortunate on Money Talks to be able to talk to and call on Terry Glavin when we talk. Well, there's a lot of subjects Terry covers, but I'm going to talk specifically about the Chinese interference and the inquiry there. But you can find him at therealstory.substack.com. I am a subscriber. Many of our fellow Money Talks listeners are, and it's worthwhile. That's why people subscribe to stuff, because the background that I get informed with, and I know these subjects, but not near as well as Terry Glavin does. So I get the background, I get some history, I get the latest stuff. So that's why I'm so pleased that he is kind enough to share his time with us. Terry, thank you for taking this time. I know, hey, there's no shortage of things that are keeping you busy these days.
Well, it's always nice to talk to you, Mike. It's always nice to talk to you. I learned from you, too. I learned from you, by the way.
Oh, well, that's nice to hear. I'll just say that.
It was only recently I discovered it was buy low, sell high. So,
yeah. There you go. Terry, I want to, you know, as I say, we could talk about a lot of areas that you're covering these days and are incredibly important areas, but I want to come to that Chinese inquiry. You've been on that story probably longer than you like to remember. I didn't even have gray hair when you started to write about that stuff.
Yeah.
So it is important. But the inquiry itself, for me, it just to see it in one place, if you know what I mean, certain levels of testimony, I just was head shaking. So let me just start with this. What was your takeaway from the inquiry? What do you think I should take away?
Yeah, it was peculiar. It was a very odd experience for me because, you know, covering it, watching the proceedings, reading as many of mm-hmm. the the submissions and exhibits as I could get my hand on. The commission's archiving is just terrible. There were a lot of people complaining, a lot of the council complaining about that. But the odd thing was, it was kind of a paradox in that in one sense, it wasn't really that much news because much of what we heard, we've been hearing directly from CSIS, from reports of the National Security and Intelligence Committee of Parliamentarians, from the Communication Security Establishment, from memos coming out of the Privy Council Office, from the Intelligence Assessment Secretariat, for the last 5-10 years, particularly intensely over the last 3 years, in leaks from CSIS agents, mainly to Sam Cooper, Bob Fife, and Steve Chase. So curiously, a lot of this stuff, when you read the headlines from the hearings, it's like, wait a minute, I saw that headline, you know, like 3 years ago. There was one headline I remember that was almost exactly the same as a headline on a piece that I had written. I think it was 12 years ago.
Wow.
What's interesting is that the interesting thing is that the CSIS stuff that's coming out, the CSIS documents that are coming out, are confirming everything that has been reported and sort of alleged, and everything that the Prime Minister's office and his cabinet members, his cabinet ministers, have been denying over the past 3 years have been confirmed and are being confirmed. And the interesting, so there's, that's the first thing. The second thing is, the from the very beginning, the government, the federal government, the Trudeau particularly, the Prime Minister's office particularly, have been denying, blockading, filibustering, you know, bringing in David Johnston for that absolutely disgraceful whitewash of a report. And all of it was, and also, you know, the mischief that they were making at the House committees that were established that were trying to get into the, get to the bottom of the extent of Chinese interference in the election. They, you know, they didn't want this inquiry to happen, we should remember. They pulled out all the stops to prevent the inquiry from happening. And the strategy now, I mean, they were, you know, the strategy was, well, it's just the conservative sour grapes, or it's, you know, they're borrowing from the Trump playbook and trying to undermine confidence in Canadian elections, or it's racist, or Han Dong is an upstanding Canadian citizen. I don't know what what people are talking about. To actually quite actively attempting to undermine public confidence in the Canadian Security Intelligence Service particularly.
That was certainly one of my takeaways. I was shocked at how critical they were to deflect, and that's why I was glad that Mr. Vigneault came back basically say, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? You know? I mean, they were out like, you know, lie is a strong word, but it's justified when someone says this didn't happen and it did.
Yeah.
You know, when they're saying, oh, I didn't really hear this, I didn't read it. And he says, I think it was off the top of my head. I gave it to you 22 times.
Yeah, you know? Actually 34 times.
Okay, yeah.
34 different CSIS documents since 2018 have gone into these subjects very, very, very intensely. You know, very specific things that Jeremy Broadhurst, for instance, or Katie Telford, who was, you know, the campaign manager for the Liberal during the 2021 election, and Katie Telford, his chief of staff, saying, "Oh my goodness, we haven't heard any of this stuff before. It's all news to us." Am I losing my marbles here?
Yeah,
this stuff. CSIS, the director of operations for CSIS, I think it was, gave this testimony verbatim in public committee hearings. David Vigneault, in a number of speeches, submissions to the National Security and Intelligence Committee of Parliamentarians, what a mouthful, that have been published by NSI, it's all there. It's all there. And they're saying, oh, gosh, you know, he didn't know. And one of the more outrageous things that I think came out of the hearings, it's just like, I can't understand how these people can sleep at night. is Trudeau saying, kind of seems implausible that the Chinese would want the Liberals to be reelected over the Conservatives. What?
Yeah.
And then who was it? LeBlanc saying, yeah, I just don't think CSIS is smart enough to figure out the political preferences of the Chinese Communist Party. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
You have on the record the China Times, Xinhua, major figures in the Chinese Communist Party, the ambassador, for God's sake, in Ottawa, saying, you know, how horrible Aaron O'Toole is and how, you know, this anti-China, and, you know, his predecessor, was it Li Keqiang? No, it wasn't. What was his name? I forget. But the ambassador before said, well, all our concerns, you know, it's white supremacy.
Yeah.
They wanted a liberal minority government. They wanted Aaron O'Toole's career to be destroyed. They wanted particularly Michael Chong and Kenny Chu and Jenny Kwan, bless her heart, the sole yes. Democrat in this picture. They wanted them gone, and they got rid of them. And the Chinese consul in Vancouver said in a conversation that was intercepted by CSIS, he was boasting about it.
Yeah,
we got rid of those guys. And for them to say, gosh, this is news to us and seems implausible, when you had, you know, people have to remember that the Trudeau government got elected to serve the purposes that the United Front Work Department is devoted to and is assigned to carry out. The United Front Work Department is, it's been recently merged with the Overseas Chinese Affairs Office. It is the overseas strong arm, influence peddling, palm greasing infrastructure of the Politburo of the Communist Party of China, Chinese Communist Party. And its budget is bigger than that of the entire Chinese foreign ministry. And they are deeply integrated and embedded in the Mandarin bloc in this country. And it's a very awkward and an indelicate subject to raise, but I'm afraid it's true.
Yeah.
And what do you do? You know, the way I put it is like, what do you do, right? If you're a CSIS agent and it's your brief, you know, you're working with your Five Eyes partners in the US, FBI, CIA, and you're working with MI6 and MI5 and in Britain and with the Australians and the Kiwis. And your job is to keep an eye on the United Front Work Department and its operations in, say, the Greater Toronto Area.
Mm-hmm.
And you find very, very quickly that all of the senior operatives in the United Front Work Department are indistinguishable from the senior fundraising, king-making, candidate selection individuals in the Liberal Party of Canada. What do you do? So, you know, I mean, it really is that bad. It's gone that deep. And I don't know. I have a couple of theories about why the penny hasn't quite dropped yet. But that's basically how deep it is.
Well, you know, I mean, I was surprised. I wasn't aware of them having, first of all, nomination meetings where 14-year-olds could vote because they can't drive and they can't do many things. They're not considered an adult. And then we find out, and thanks to you at therealstory.substack.com, you know, you were writing about the fact that the United Front Work Group was actually threatening the students who were getting bussed in. You know, you better vote this way. You better cooperate. And I don't know what I expected, but that was obviously a revelation to me, but a shocking one.
Yeah, and Han Dong and both Han Dong and Trudeau have behaved from the very beginning. When I say the very beginning, I mean I guess it was it February 2023 or was it anyway when Sam Cooper's story started to break.
Mm-hmm.
You know, denying up and down that this had been happening. And then, you know, the more granular detail we started to get on it, Han Dong has changed his story three or four times.
Yeah.
He's lately recruited that. Yeah, I was recruiting students from that school. It's the new Oriental College or something mm-hmm. like that. which, by the way, has its own Communist Party unit embedded in the faculty. Chinese Communist Party. And Trudeau had been at dinners at that school. And, you know, here's the funny thing. You don't actually need a CSIS. If you know, if you pay really close attention over the years and you develop contacts in the community, it's not like they didn't know. They knew.
Yeah.
They knew. They knew before Sam Cooper's stories came out. They knew before Jeremy Broadhurst was briefed by CSIS that there were all these irregularities at Handong's nomination. They knew before Broadhurst advised Trudeau, briefed Trudeau on what CSIS had told him. They knew before the candidate rate election itself, months before they knew. Anybody paying attention knew. I knew. I talked to Gerald Butts about this. I said, what is the deal? Handong is their guy. He launched, he made his announcement that he was going to run for the Liberal nomination in Don Valley North from the headquarters of the main United Front Work Department structure in the Greater Toronto area, which is the Confederation of Chinese Canadian Organizations, I think it's called. Big shot there is a fellow by the name of Wei Cheng Yi. He's a multi-millionaire. He's a real estate and grocery chain magnate. He was a former member of the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference in Beijing, only from a couple of years ago. He was the director of Overseas Chinese Affairs Office institution that was run directly from the Ninth Bureau of the United Front Work Department. The guy is like the godfather, right?
Yeah.
And he announced, and one of his branch plants, by the way, remember those Chinese police stations?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, one of them was in one of his branch. It was the same address. He was the landlord. And so he announces his candidacy from Wei Cheng-Yi's headquarters. Michael Chan is standing right behind him. Michael Chan had been, you know, has been watched by CSIS for years. Michael Chan was also in 2019. The co-chair of our trade minister's election campaign, Mary Ng. I mean, what do you do, right? You're just a guy. You're a CSIS agent. You're tapping phones. You're writing stuff down. Everybody knew, Michael. Everybody knew. And what does Mike, you know, what does Butt say to me? Oh, I've known Handong since he was a kid. He's just a fine. It's like accusing Terry Glavin of being a sleeper cell for the Irish Republican Army. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly. I think a lot of people read this stuff and it's so outlandish. It's so unbelievable that a lot of people think, this can't be true.
Conservatives
saying outrageous things.
Interesting you're saying that though, because that's exactly what my impression is too. This can't be true. Are you kidding me? They've got Chinese police stations in Canada. You know, you're kidding me. They're training the Chinese police in Banff. You know, there was so many of those, though, like just a laundry list of things like that. And you go, come on, they couldn't have really interfered in the election. And yet I remember you writing back in 2017, you know, about the Financial Times story that showed that same United Front work group boasting that six of its candidates had been elected in the GTA. In 2003.
I think it was 14 or 20 in the following year. That goes back to 2003.
That's what I mean. But you still go. And I think that's what I thought, though, was valuable about this inquiry. And you get it all in one or a lot of it in one go. And you go, oh, boy, you know, it sort of creates credibility, which I hope gives you at least some solace for the kind of work you've done or Sam does or, you know.
Well, a little bit, you know, like. Late last year when the House Affairs Committee on China released its report, which had all of this evidence from CSIS, and Ken Hardy, who was the chair of the committee, nice man, he's liberal, you know, he said, well, I guess we, you know, we should have been listening to Jonathan Manthorpe and Terry Glavin all along. Well, that's very nice of you, Ken. But you know what? It doesn't seem to have really made a difference. And I think part of the difficulty is we've been covering this story in under the sort of rubric of foreign interference.
Yes. Right?
Well, is it interference if it is? I mean, interference is something that is unwanted and unhelpful. There was nothing unwanted or unhelpful about the participation of the United Front Work Department hierarchy in the Mandarin bloc in this country and the consulates and the embassy. There was nothing unwanted in their engagement with the Liberal Party. It looks a lot more like collusion to me. I know these are terrible things to say. But, you know, you explained, somebody's got to explain to me, and no one has explained this yet, how it came to pass that over a 48-hour period in 2016, so we're going back a ways, right after the election, over a 48-hour period, 68%, I think it was, of the Papineau, Trudeau's riding, his war chest, was replenished by... all of these donations that just curiously were just below the $1,500 threshold. I mean, that's what happens when you look at, you know, casino gambling. Mm-hmm. When you look at the way Chinese whale gamblers get their money out of China, you know, they'll distribute or buy houses in Shaughnessy. You know, they'll distribute a whole bunch of below the radar donations to various people in Canada who will put it in a single bank account, and then a big lump sum goes to a bank in China, this kind of thing. Somebody rigged that. You know, I think it was like 62 different donations in one 48-hour period minimum. And then you have the prime minister of our country inviting Liberal donors to cash for access dinners, one of which, by the way, I think the first was Li Keqiang attended this dinner. I mean, his policy was to integrate Canada's economy and our immigration policy and our foreign policy hip and thigh with the Chinese state-owned enterprises, the Chinese government's foreign policy economy. I mean, it's all there. It's on the record. It's, and I think this is the part of the difficult, you know, people look at this and they just say, some people look at it and they say, what do they have on Trudeau? My goodness. You know, they must have something on him. You know, surely he wouldn't be doing this sort of thing unless they had some sort of, you know, compromising information on him. People have to wake up and realize that Trudeau and his circle, Dominic Barton, Peter Harder, Yenpao Wu, Mary Ng, all of the, they don't see anything wrong with this. This is not something to be, it's something to be hidden from the public because they know that the public finds all of this quite revolting. But they don't see things this way. They have a completely different conception. Yeah, this sort of post-national idea of the country. And of course, the immediate question that emerges is, well, how do you do national security in a post-national state? What does that even mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think a lot of this stuff is coming out now sort of on the record in the trove of terribly, utterly, I mean, there's no indexing at all in the archive of submissions to the inquiry. I mean, it would be a really interesting project to hire a summer student to go through everything and properly organize and index the submissions. But yeah, it's going to be interesting. We've got, you know, we have an opportunity now for the United Front Work Department and its senior interlocutor, who's basically recognized as such by Justice Hogue. Yenpao Wu, he's going to be defending them and defending their interests. You know, they're some sort of equity-seeking group now.
Well, it's been an overwhelming task to keep on top of it. That I'm not telling you anything because you've been keeping on top of it, and I appreciate your time here. But there's so many more chapters to go in this story that I hope I can call on you. But in the meantime,
yeah, sorry to bang on like this. This should really be more of a conversation, but it's
it is
overwhelming. There's just so much.
Well, but that's why I highly recommend therealstory.substack.com, you know, and Substack, The Real Story, because I find on this and many other subjects, by the way, that are very pertinent these days, but I'm talking about this particular Chinese interference today, but it's absolutely necessary background to keep informed. And this is me saying it. If you care about your country, my goodness, I hope it supersedes any partisan affiliation. If you care about Canada, and certainly interference with our fundamental rights in democracy should be a huge concern. And Terry, you've done yeoman's work, and I'm glad you alluded to Sam Cooper,
he's great.
Jeremy Nuttall, to Stephen Chase, and you know, because it's the best of journalism, the best of journalism at a time when journalism isn't held in high esteem, and I think deservedly so in many cases. But in this case, journalists have led the way, and you're certainly leading that charge. And I so sincerely appreciate your work, but also appreciate you finding time for us here.
Anytime, Michael. Anytime. Well,
great stuff. Great stuff. Well, lots to talk about all day. We've been talking about the federal budget, but I want to have a particular look at that and the housing market. I think they were calling it a housing budget, so I'm going to bring in Ozzy Jurek. You can find him at ozbuzz.ca. Ozzy, let's just start with, again, I'm just talking about impact on housing. There was a ton of housing announcements within the budget. They've been making them for about 3 weeks here. Your overall impression, I'll start with this. You know, they've talked about increasing the capital gains tax, the inclusion rate from 50% to 2/3. Again, your take on that?
Well, you know, I mean, it's been proven that if you increase the taxes, the money will go somewhere else. We have innovation lacking. We have productivity lacking. And now as an entrepreneur, I create something, I spend money, it takes me years to get a return. I'm looking for that return to be substantial. Well, it's now gone in capital gains inclusion tax rate from 50% to 66.6% for money over 250,000. And Michael, if I have a building right now, and I know of two that that have a considerable profit potential built up over the years, they want to sell before June 25th because for no good reason to them, it just all of a sudden becomes a major expense. We even had a couple of guys on the Facebook site saying that they want to sell their rental property. They've given their tenants notice. They just don't want to do it anymore, right? It's just this, as we said last week, on the between the 40% flipping tax on the federal government, the 20% flipping tax on the BC government, the 5% GST, and the 2.5% property transfer tax, that's 67% of your profit. Why not just put the money in the bank? So there's a real cold reaction to the increase in capital gains tax.
The point you're making, though, is very important because I've read a lot of sort of, I'm going to say it, academic economists weighing in on this, but they never took it from the investor's point of view, from the attract the capital point of view. And one of the things they fail to understand is that this tax increase on the capital gains comes amidst a whole bunch of other things impacting landlords or impacting developers. And the response you got, by the way, Ozzy, is exactly the one I got. I almost immediately, I mean literally within 10 hours, I got notes from two people saying they are going to put their place up, they're going to give notice, going to work with the tenant, but they've owned the building for like 20 years, 25 years going back. So, you know, they're going to be caught in the capital gains problem. And they just, again, but it was more, they threw up their hands saying, enough already. How come every time, you know, I feel this kind of impact? And as you say, and you've been talking about this for a while, you know, at times it's just easier to take that 5% in the bank, you know, or in the T-bill. And that, well, I don't think the government appreciates that at all. And I know some economists who clearly didn't appreciate that aspect on the impact on investors.
The words like risk capital. There is a risk. You know, the risk, and it has happened. The owner goes bankrupt. The developer can't finish. The costs are higher. All these risks. And for that, the government takes 3/4 of it. Anyways, the point is, you know, this is just another chip on your head.
I think that's the key here. It's, you know, the straw that breaks the camel's back for more people. Okay, I'm going to come to some of the specifics very quickly here and just get your comment on it. You've got an increase in home buyers plan limit allowing first-time buyers to withdraw more from their RRSP. Individuals could withdraw up to $60,000, a couple obviously $120,000, but that's a home buyer plan limit. That will be increased. What's your take on it?
Well, you know, it's okay because it allows you to have, you have to pay it back first of all. You can't just take it out. You have to pay it back over 15 years. But the point is, it's first-time buyers only for their first-time house. And who is a first-time buyer for the first-time house who has $60,000 in the RSP? I wouldn't think that of that many.
Certainly isn't young people. I mean, they're not socking the money away in RSPs to, you know, maybe they will a little bit later, but, you know, retirement seems an awfully long way off. And I think that's the challenge. I saw a lot of things in the budget. I'm not knocking them. I'm just saying the impact's going to be very minor. Same with like a 30-year amortization, you know, on a mortgage.
Yeah. Yeah, the 30-year mortgage, it sounds all good. Okay, they have longer to pay. But what it actually means is for every $100,000 that I go from 25 years to 30 years on, it's about $50 in my monthly payment. So if I have a $500,000 mortgage, it will help me not having to pay $250. But Mike, in the scope of things, it is not a major deal. And we have had 30-year mortgages forever. Remember also, it's the very people that need it don't get it because it's only available for new home, built home. So I can't have it on an older built home. And before you had it available already if you had more than 20% down, it has always been available at 30-year term. So this now makes it available ostensibly to the lower able buyers, but it's only for newly built homes.
Well, the other side is this, is if any of the measures that are supposed to increase, make it easier for me to get in the market, or if I'm a homeowner to buy or trade up or whatever it is, but more buyers, that's actually a problem. You know, because we are already well undersupplied. The government acknowledges that in the same budget. They talk about building 3.87 million new homes. So clearly, we've got a supply problem. I'm just saying, hey, you don't maybe want to juice demand when you already have a supply problem.
Well, the other interesting thing, Mike, is, you know, they have no plan how to get to 3.87. Yeah. They promised to unlock 3.87 million houses. That's good. I mean, I'll help them with the key.
Well, at the same, but and again, just again, people haven't been quite up to date on it. No, the government itself admits they have no plan for that. You know, they made that announcement, 3.87 million new homes by 2031. They don't actually have a plan, or they say we don't have the details, which would kind of be important if you're going to achieve that goal. You know, let me go over a couple of other things. You know, but they already do have a plan. We'll see how it goes. They got a $15 billion. Kind of fund for apartment loan construction program. So, I mean, that could help out.
Yeah, well, although, you know, it's nothing new. It's been around since 2017, and it has a measure of success because some people had access to the loans. But, I mean, we're talking it's a six-year-old program that they're sort of dusting off as something new. There have been, Mike, about 7% of all of the construction in apartments have been taken loans from that program. So it's an addition. But it's not something new. It's always been there. They promised to make the access easier. Now, what that means is the devil is in the details.
I'll finish with one thing, Ozzy, that, again, doesn't get recognized, is considering that the government is into deficit financing for, you know, the foreseeable future. They've been in deficit financing. We do have record debt. We have a monster amount of debt coming due off the top of my head, I think $280 billion. That is all upward pressure on interest rates. You know, they're going to have to borrow. That puts upward pressure on rates. And, of course, in the end, that has a huge impact on mortgages. And, of course, mortgages are the number one contributor to inflation. I mean, the irony is the Bank of Canada could lower interest rates, bring a mortgage down, and we'd be better on inflation. But so far, they haven't chosen that. But I just thought that gets overlooked, that the deficit financing, upward pressure on interest rates, not good news.
No, I mean, $54 billion in interest charges mean $1 billion a week is now just the cost of the interest. Yeah. It's more than the health transfer to the provinces and so on. I mean, it is a very, very expensive budget, particularly when they have promised to There's no plan to ever get into balance. Never. Yeah.
Well, as I say, good news for you. You're never going to have to look for subjects to talk about because this housing crisis is going to continue, and people can get help with understanding it by going to ozbuzz.ca, ozbuzz.ca. So, Ozzy, go out and have a great week.
Thanks, Mike, and the sun is shining. You know, I always keep people hammering me on, stop eating ice cream and get a good-looking body. Well, it's not my intention to have a good-looking body into my grave. What I want to do is got to come in sideways. Chardonnay in one hand, chocolate in the other, body thoroughly used up, screaming, woohoo, what a ride.
And that's quite a visual to end off with, jurok.ca. Let's go live to the trading desk now. I got to bring Victor Adair in. Vic, one of the things that hit me, you know, because we did the show last weekend, and then all of a sudden on Sunday, I think it was Sunday, we get the Iranian strikes against Israel. You know, I mean, talk about a game changer. Then I'm going to flash forward also into, I think it was, the retaliation that came Thursday, you know, from Israel, because the market was on sort of tenterhooks waiting for that. It's just fascinating to see the market react and have these major events influence market action.
Well, they certainly did. I mean, I might as well have had my sleeping bag here at my desk. I mean, mm-hmm. It's been that kind of week, and it's been very volatile, like across spaces, whether you're looking at precious metals, the currency markets, interest rates, or the stocks. But I think, and then there's the assessment, you know, all of a sudden, like everybody's a foreign affairs expert. You know, the thing wasn't as serious as they thought. And they only did this because of that and all that kind of stuff. But when it was hitting the tape, I mean, especially here on Thursday night, I guess, because markets were open. The attacks last weekend, the markets were actually closed. And I think the whole world was waiting on tenterhooks for the markets to reopen, you know, on Sunday afternoon to see what would happen. Actually, the Sunday afternoon opening wasn't much of a big deal, you know, compared to what everybody had been thinking, you know, war is breaking out in the Middle East. But on Thursday night here, the across the board, and let me give you just one example, the Mexican peso, okay, this has been the strongest currency in the world. It's even stronger than the U.S. dollar. It was at 9-year highs against the U.S. dollar. And all of a sudden, in thin trading conditions around 6:30, 7 o'clock, whatever it was, West Coast time here, Asian markets, the peso was down like 5%. There was no bid for the Mexican peso. I mean, it quickly came back again, but just that reminds me of so many other crisis kind of times I've seen in the markets over the years when all of a sudden something happens and the market just goes, oh my God.
Yeah. Well, I really want people to note that because one takeaway is one of the things I think is that people, I don't sense that there's an appreciation for the geopolitical risk factoring into a lot of people's approach to investment and how surprises happen. But the other side you've just alluded to, we have been talking about on Money Talk starting on September 16th, 2019, when the overnight repo market went no bid, you know, all of a sudden, and rates went from 2% annualized to 10% annualized. You know, it's beyond people's imagination. And your point about the Mexican peso, you know, presto, down 5%. Because there's no bid. You know, people back off. Yeah, it's a quiet time of trading at that time. But still, people back off. I still think that kind of liquidity challenge is the biggest risk in the markets for me, you know.
Well, for sure. And we've talked here so many times, I call it positioning. You know, if the market's been going up, the longer it goes up, the more gentle, as it were, the rally is, the more people get more involved and more aggressive. So the peso had been bid aggressively higher. The short-term interest rates in Mexico were 11, 11.5% against, say, 5% in the States. You know, almost anybody would take their money across the border and pick up the yield. Yeah. And that was happening on a massive scale. But when it came time to unwind that trade, nobody wanted to be on the other side of it. So, yeah, you asked, markets were breathlessly volatile and just gapping, you know, minute to minute. And you're just wondering, where do we find some kind of a level we could start to see a two-way market again?
Well, and just, you know, a five-seconder on this one. But, you know, you got to note the volatility when you look at something like NVIDIA, the all-star stock.
Well, NVIDIA certainly was, and at the end of this week here, it was, I think we're down to 2 or 3 month lows and getting sold off hard. something gets popular, people pile into it. There was levered ETFs for them to get into the tech space so you could really, you know, get your head in a bucket of poison. Pardon me, I shouldn't say that, but I'm just saying some people, you know, when the market's going your way, you get too aggressive. I've talked so many times, Mike, about, you know, I make money from not because I've got a great crystal ball, but because I am really good at managing risk. And I think the first place to manage risk is in sizing your position. Mm-hmm. You know, when people get aggressive about something, you know, that's when they're exposed to bad things happening.
Well, you know, and always the funny thing when people talk about maybe some stocks they had, you know, of course, when the stock goes up, they go, oh, I should have owned that 10 times as much, you know, but it, exactly. A professional looks at the positioning risk, doesn't look back like that and say, yeah, I wish I had sold my house and put all my money in gold this last few weeks, you know, that kind of thing, but it's nonsense. But let me finish with gold, Vic, another record high this week.
Yeah, gold has, there's some folks that I follow out of London that sort of show you a little inside baseball about what's going on. There has been massive over-the-counter option buying in the gold market. It looks like somebody like a big hedge fund or whatever is making a huge play that the gold is going to go higher. I made a note in my trading desk notes to this last week saying, you know, those people may be doing that, and they also may have been trying to ignite buying to the upside, you know, and selling into it. It's the old pump and dump scheme that, you know, given we're from in Vancouver, we know all about pump and dump.
Well, great stuff, Vic, as usual. And again, all the more reason to look at what your notes are, because look at these different markets, the level of volatility, the level of change, all of that coming at you. So that's victoradair.ca, victoradair.ca. It's absolutely free. But man, I love it when I come on and I look and there's a chart. Oh, I hadn't seen that chart. Or it might be a market I'm not following also. I mean, you've been doing a great job on the yen, 34-year low, you know, but we started to watch it on Money Talks thanks to you going back quite a while. You know, so it's victoradair.ca. Vic, have a terrific week.
Thanks, Mike.
Time now for this week's Goofy Award. And for it, I'm going to return to the housing file, but I'm going to start with a comment by Calgary Mayor Gondek. She said in quotes, "We're starting to see this segment of the population who are rejecting this idea of owning a home, and they're moving towards a rental because it gives them more freedom." Well, I'm sure there are some people who want to rent, but come on, there's a much bigger segment who simply can't afford to buy, along with many who already own a home and can't afford the property taxes or the maintenance and the upkeep. Oh, insurance costs have gone way up. And of course, you've got increased mortgage payments and other costs of home ownership. But that's not the goofiest statement. As I alluded to in the opening comment, that's got to be the federal government in the budget saying they're going to build 3.87 million more homes in the next 7 years. Come on, really? Anybody want to bet, by the way? Because I'll take all comers on that one. I'm not going to talk about the failed housing promises of the past. I mean, we've got their political opponents are already doing that. I'm talking about simply the reality of building 3.87 million homes in 7 years. I mean, that's laughable or cryable if you're looking for an affordable home or affordable rent. To start with, 3.87 million is more than the amount built in the last 20 years combined. And the record housing start in any given year, now think about this, is 274,000. That was way back in 1976. So 3.87 million by 2031 means that we need to average 553,000 housing starts a year. That's more than double the all-time high. And come on, it's about 2.5 times the average that we've been building in the last 10 years. I mean, and plus, keep in mind, I'm saying this, but you got to do it every year. It's got to be 550 plus thousand every single year. And given that right now, we're not even close. 2023 was way below that. 2024 is going to be way below it. 2025, way below it. Well, come on, in the latter years to get into that 2031, they've got to be going way higher to make up for the fact we didn't build 553,000 on average for the first few years. Oh my gosh, the math just doesn't add up. And that's before we even factor in the massive increase we'd need in the number of construction workers. but we'd need the number of electricians or plumbers and other skilled trades, plus the number of municipal bylaw and building inspectors. No, it just doesn't add up. And the final blow, well, keep in mind, beginning of this year, federal government had no housing plan, and that's according to the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation head, Romy Bowers. So $3.87 million, come on, not going to happen. But it simply creates another credibility problem for the finance minister and the federal government. So I don't know why they do that kind of thing, make these lofty promises. This one in the budget, for goodness sakes, and it's not going to happen. Hey, that's all the time we have this week. I want to remind you, though, please go to Money Talks Tweets or join us on mikesmoneytalks.ca and, of course, Michael Campbell's Money Talks on Facebook. And again, I keep saying this. I can't believe how many really important items are out there that don't make it into the newscast maybe you're watching or listening to, other mainstream media. So you got to keep up to date. I appreciate when you recommend Money Talks to people and your friends. Also recommend Money Talks Tweets and Michael Campbell's Money Talks on Facebook. In the meantime, I hope you go out and have an absolutely terrific week.